I'm John Krall. On today's No Limits, we're going to talk cars. For more than a century, the month of May in Indiana has been the time when some of the fastest cars and drivers in the world come here for the Indianapolis 500. We're going to talk about Indiana's long love affair with automobiles and the culture that love has produced. My guest will be Indianapolis Motor Speedway historian Donald Davidson. Katie Haig with the Indianapolis Museum of Art, which has an exhibit called Dream Cars, and Scott Hope, the host of the Mecum Auctions broadcasts on NBC Sports Network and a former announcer at IMS. Please call in at 866-476-3881. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about Indiana's car culture, about Hoosiers' love affair with automobiles. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests today are Indianapolis Motor Speedway historian Donald Davidson, Katie Haig, who is the deputy director of the Indianapolis Museum of Art, which has an exhibit called Dream Cars, and Scott Hoke, familiar voice here at WFYI and here in Indianapolis, the host of the Mecum Auctions broadcast on NBC Sports Network and a former public address announcer at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you, John. Thank
you. It's good to have you all here. I'm gonna start with kind of a basic question, and that is Indiana ever so slightly more car crazy than many other places? Donald, I'll start with you first.
Oh, I don't know that I'd have an answer for that. I think I have a hard time putting myself in modern times. I still think of California as being car crazy. At one time, Indianapolis was a leading producer of automobiles. Sometimes we see reference to it being the leader. It was never the leader, but it wasn't necessarily Detroit or even Michigan. I think Cleveland at one time produced more automobiles than any other city, but Indianapolis was always up there, and that's from the right after the turn of the last century until it started to go away in the 1930s. But as far as Indiana being car crazy, I don't know that that's the description I would use for right now.
Katie, how about you?
Well, not being an Indiana native, I would say that there are a lot of car enthusiasts here that I have not experienced elsewhere, but I think it's also a great draw for the city. That's really why we're doing the Dream Cars exhibition, because it seemed like a nice synergy in terms of extending our love and celebration of design to the automobile and knowing that our audience would embrace that.
Scott, you get the last word on this first go-around.
You know, it's funny that Donald mentioned California, because other than Indianapolis and Indiana, that's the first state that came to mind. Of course, the car culture in California is so strong, quite a bit different than it is here. But I think maybe not from a manufacturing standpoint, as he pointed out, but going all the way back to the early days of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, I think a lot of the passion for the automobile came out of racing. And this is the racing capital of the world, and it has been that for so long that even though, you know, the manufacturing wasn't all happening here, a lot of people became passionate and crazy. I call them car crazies, crazy about the automobile based on what they did on the racetrack, and then it translated into passenger cars so well.
Well, and some of what, you know, California's fascination with cars is the fact that, you know, with the commutes people have out there and all of that, you know, your car actually, the amount of time you spend in your car can rival the amount of time you spend in the office
exactly.
or at your home.
You better like your car if you're in California.
What makes Indiana, I think, interesting, we don't have those long commutes. And while we were, have been a really significant manufacturer of automobiles, as Donald's pointed out, we were never the center of that universe.
Correct.
But in some ways, particularly in this month, we do become the center mm-hmm. of the automobile universe. What accounts for that, Scott?
Well, I think, Donald is the guy to talk about that. But it's the history of Indianapolis. I mean, so many people have been quoted, race drivers have been quoted as saying the Indianapolis 500 made my career. A.J. Foyt, I think, is one of those guys. And it has been for so many years the racing capital of the world and continues to this day. It's the biggest single-day sporting event on the planet, and it's the biggest race in the world, period. Everybody has a dream of racing at the Indianapolis 500 still.
Donald, then I'm going to throw the question to you. Why did the Indianapolis 500 emerge as the premier racing event in the world? I mean, there have been a lot of other races, but Scott's right. I mean, there's the Indianapolis 500, and then there's sort of everything else.
But before I answer that, I'd like to maybe I didn't state my myself very well that Indianapolis definitely was one of the centers. I think mm-hmm. at the time the track was built, it ranked fourth in terms of automobiles, and you've got to distinguish between Indiana and Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. And I think in 1913, the figures show that it ranked second. So it was up there. And, mm-hmm. and Stutz was from here, and Marmon, and then right after the war, the Duesenberg brothers relocated here because they thought this was the place to be.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as to your question about the Indianapolis 500, there was automobile racing. There was major automobile racing, probably the major event in this country starting in 1904 was the Vanderbilt Cup on Long Island, which was road racing. And then there was the American Grand Prix at Savannah, Georgia, came along. But when the Indianapolis Speedway was built, as a combination testing facility for the automobile industry, because the roads were not developed. There were some states that were appropriating funds for the development of roads, and Indiana was not one of them. And so in order to test automobiles, using the open road was no longer feasible because automobiles were capable of greater speeds than the roads could provide. So for a while, they actually used the Indiana State Fairgrounds, which was a one-mile dirt track where they run the Hoosier 100 mm-hmm. to this day. On that track, they were testing there, 1903, 1904, 1905. Wasn't long before that became outmoded as well. And so that was the reason for the track being built, not as a sporting facility, but as a place for manufacturers would have a place to go and test privately. But then occasionally automobile races would be held, the entrants being the manufacturers and the dealers, to show the public how good their cars were. I mean, if you didn't own an automobile yet and you didn't know what to buy, you didn't know, you'd read the print advertising and in order to make up your mind, the thinking was, go to a track and watch races with stripped-down passenger cars, and you could decide for yourself what is the what you want to go down to the showroom and take a closer look at. So that was the reason for the place being built. When the 500 was held for the first time in 1911, some people think that was what opened the track. But the track was in its third season when they had the 500-mile race. And with the various trials and tribulations that they'd had up to that point that we won't go into now, the 500 in 1911 was a home run, and they just wanted to have a long race that would start at 10 o'clock in the morning and be over at around 5:30, 6:30 or so. And so they figured out that 500 miles would be what they could run in that time. And I've been thinking about this quite a bit. I'm not too sure that there had ever been a race that was all 500 miles duration, because most of the races at that time were either sprint-type events on short tracks with just a few laps, or the epic races were on road courses, and it would be, you know, 231.7 miles or something like that, whereas this was strictly for 500 miles, and it just captured everybody's imagination the first time. And so here we are about to run for the 99th time, and I know I'm giving you a long answer here, but it's set apart still to this day, probably the closest event to the Indianapolis 500, I think, would be the Kentucky Derby. And I only went there once, but I didn't decide this for myself, because I mean that's been stated many times. But I went down there myself, and I thought, by golly, there's so much similarity between the two events, because it's at the same time every year at the same location, and the people there are third, fourth, fifth generation attendees.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about Indiana's car culture here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Katie, I'm assuming it was no accident that the exhibition Dream Cars at IMA is during the month of May. How did the exhibition come together?
Sure. Well, this is something we've been talking about doing for several years. Over the last 7 years, we've actually collected over 3,000 what we call contemporary and modern design objects. This is a new collection area that we have developed recently. And as part of that collection, we have industrial design as well as one-of-a-kind unique objects that are custom-made. So when I say industrial design, I mean everything from iPhones to Dyson vacuums. And an automobile is really an extension of that. You think about high design, and why not look at the automobile? We have so many great cars at the Speedway and locally. But here you can see the concept cars, which are basically showing the evolution of the automobile in terms of design and technology. Over the last, 80 or 90 years. And basically, once we found Ken Gross, who was is a curator, and he was formerly the director of the Peterson Museum in California, we asked Ken to work with us to develop a concept that would work for Indy. And we actually tested four or five different concepts with our audience, and the concept cars was one that was off the charts in terms of the response of our audience and what they wanted to see here in Indianapolis. So it was a really nice fit for us. The exhibition was actually originated at the High Museum of Art in Atlanta. They have been a really good partner to us in the past. We've sent exhibitions to them, and they've sent exhibitions to us, and their director is very good friends with our director, Charles Venable. So it was a really easy process. Once we started talking to them, we have basically the same checklist of group of automobiles that they had there in Atlanta just about a year ago. And we basically had to go to every single lender and negotiate the terms. And, of course, they were all very eager to lend. They said basically, where else should we do this? Indianapolis. That's the obvious choice. So we were really lucky that all of our lenders were so enthusiastic. We have so many individual lenders who are private automobile collectors, as well as museums and even corporations.
Katie, how do you define a dream car?
Well, a dream car is something that is unique, usually something that was not produced, or for mass production rather. It is something that is shows the automobile manufacturer's prowess in terms of developing advanced technologies. So we're looking at cars beginning in the 30s. So the automobile manufacturers have kind of perfected the inside, and now they're looking at the outside, and they're making them a little curvier, a little bit longer, a little bit lower, looking at all these advanced technologies in terms of testing, what their consumer wants. So they might develop a car that they would never put into production that has all these fancy things like a retractable top or, fabric-covered cars or rain sensors and proximity sensors. and things that we take for granted that maybe they were looking at for the first time in the 40s and the 50s, and then they were testing their consumers to see which one of these features they would want to see in the mass-produced automobiles that they would make later. So it was really, for us, it's something that is very unique, something that is in some cases one of a kind. Some of these cars were actually, again, made just by individuals, not automobile manufacturers, and some were made by automobile manufacturers for the Motoramas that happened in the 50s. You know, and they literally took these cars,
Katie,
all over the country.
Katie, we're going to have to pick this up after the break. If you are just joining us, we're talking about Indiana's car culture here on No Limits. My guests are Donald Davidson, Katie Haig, and Scott Hoke. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about Indiana's car culture. My guests are Indianapolis Motor Speedway historian Donald Davidson, Katie Haig, who is the deputy director of the Indianapolis Museum of Art, which has an exhibition called Dream Cars, and Scott Hoke, the host of the Mecum Auctions broadcast on NBC Sports Network, and a former public address announcer at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Katie, right before we went to the break, I'd asked you for what constituted the definition of a dream car, and we sort of cut you off in mid-answer to get to the break. I apologize.
That's okay. No problem. I really think that was, you know, the extent of it. Honestly, there's just so many unique features in every one of these individuals, so I think everyone just needs to come out and see them for themselves.
Scott, what's your definition of a dream car? I stump Scott here.
Well, you know, it could be, to me, that's a personal thing. It's kind of like your dream job or your dream home. It's, you know, your dream car is whatever you want it to be. If you're a Corvette lover, if you're a lover of pre-war classics like the Duesenbergs or whatever the case may be, whatever you're, and for some people it might be a race car. I know Travis on Twitter is listening today, one of my Twitter followers, and Travis is a race car driver. For him, his dream car might be one of the cars that we see out at the Motor Speedway. It's whatever you want that to be, and whatever you see yourself owning or driving someday, that's your dream car.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about Indiana's love affair with automobiles here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Donald, I've got to ask, I mean, you are a guy who basically you've devoted your entire professional life to the study of automobiles, of racing, and of the history associated with them. What triggered your passion for automobiles? I know I'm taking you back a ways, but...
Scott's probably laughing and rolling his eyes.
No,
he's not, actually. He actually is waiting for the answer, too.
I must say, Donald and I used to work together when I was a kid in high school over at the old USAC shop there just to the west of the Speedway. And he and I have had many discussions about what brought him to the States and his passion. But go ahead and answer the question, Donald.
Yeah.
Well, as far as being interested in automobiles, I did go through that briefly, but it was I grew up in England. I'm British, born and raised, and I went through several phases. You know, I liked Spanish galleons, and then I, you know, went through different things, and I was always aware of. What is known as automobile racing over here, motor racing over there, because England's not very big, and motor racing was one of the sports or the ways of life, if you like, that was it was endorsed by the British public. So I grew up when I was a little boy. I mean, I knew who race drivers were because it was like being raised in Indianapolis. Not now necessarily, but at one time, you would know who the drivers were, whether you cared about it or not, because you'd hear all these names all the time. So I was raised knowing who the drivers were, the Europeans. I also know who motorcycle racers were and test pilots. So, but it didn't really click with me until I was 13. And then all of a sudden one day, I would get racing cars in my Christmas stocking and stuff like that without it being a passion of mine. And then all of a sudden, I was 13, and it suddenly clicked, and I started seeing these names, and I listened to the Italian Grand Prix on the radio, and just got hooked. And then I found that I could memorize race winners, and then it went to seconds and thirds, and I'm talking Grand Prix. I was not a great student, but I had what I was later told was selective retentive easy access memory. Given credit for photographic memory, but that's not what it is.
I think they had to devise that category just for you.
Donald Davidson memory.
It's funny that you would say that, Scott. And I'll finish the thought, then I'll come back to that. And the Indianapolis 500 used to count towards the World Drivers' Championship, Grand Prix. The 500 was never a Grand Prix, but the 500 guys got points to the World Championship, the first five finishers. So when I would see these World Championship rundowns, I knew who Fangio was, and I knew who Sterling Marsh was, and Peter Collins and Mike Hawthorn, but Bill Vukovich and Sam Hanks, who are they? So it went from that I wanted to know more about the 500 guys, and so over a period of a few weeks, I was able to find out, get publications from the United States, and then that became my passion, and there was no end to what I was able to memorize, and I thought, I really want to go to America because it's cool, and they've got all these great cars with convertibles and two-tone. I thought America was beaches and sunshine all the time and driving around and women. So
life was a Beach Boys song, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And the beach. But when I first had that vision, the Beach Boys weren't going yet. But anyway, I'll give you a chance or somebody else to say something. But when Scott said that, one of my daughters said, that if you Google selective retentive easy access to find out more about it, there's a bunch of stuff about you comes up. you're not always humble servant. So anyway, it's several people told me that that's what it was, and it is the ability to not memorize everything, because I can't do that, but anything that strikes my fancy, I, to this point at least, have been able to memorize and retain.
Do you have, Scott just mentioned that the question of what constitutes your dream car is a really personal one.
Yeah.
And it is. I mean, their relationship, which in and of itself is sort of an odd phenomenon, that people do fall in love with cars. They fall in love with what is an inanimate object. But it is a real passion, and they have their preferences. Do you have, a favorite era in automotive history that fascinates you more than others, or a favorite car or anything like that that you follow?
Not really, because right before motor racing bit, if you like, I was interested in passenger cars, but they were mostly, I'm dating myself here, but I'm talking mid-50s, and I would buy these sort of like car spotter books and a lot of British stuff, but what I liked, the American cars. I thought hard tops were so cool, and the fact that you could roll down the windows and still have a top, and without the doorpost and convertibles. And, you know, this is back in the days of Detroit iron and white wall tires. And I just, you know, I suppose those would probably be my dream cars. But as far as the automobile industry in general, I have some interest in that, but it's about the racing rather than the automobile industry. So dream cars, I think that can mean anything. I think that probably the common perception of the dream car is the concept cars that were designs that were either never built or that was just the prototype. But I would agree with Scott that it's whatever you want or whatever you wanted when you were a kid. And whether that's an Austin Healey or a Cadillac with big fins or a Duesenberg, I don't know. It's whatever you think. That's what if money was no object or whatever, what would I have? That's your dream car.
We've gotten an email question and comment from a listener named Ryan. And if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Ryan says, thanks to all the panelists today. My son, a high school junior, is passionate about the Indiana car history story. He even has an Instagram account, Indy_cars. I've been amazed by the preservation stories that are being retold around the state through renovated cars and buildings, Kokomo, South Bend, Auburn, etc. What would the panelists see as a compelling Indiana car story that hasn't gotten the press of some of the bigger names? Katie, I'll start with you on that one.
Well, not necessarily being a car expert, I can talk about some of the connections that our dream cars have with Indiana and its history. I mean, Gordon Burig was a designer. He designed for Duesenberg. He designed the Tasco, which is in our exhibition here. So there's a whole very kind of compelling looking at designers, looking at some of the cars in the exhibition. There's the Ford's model Speedster, which influenced one of the Indianapolis 500 two-man race cars in 1935. So they definitely have influenced the design of cars that have been in Indiana. We also have, you know, a lot of racing enthusiasts. One of the cars, a Ferrari, the Triposti here, is actually owned by a former race car driver, Luigi Cinetti Jr., and his father was a race car driver as well. So we have a lot of great stories. I wouldn't, and probably they haven't been told because these cars are, you know, do not reside here normally.
Scott,
you know, it's interesting, and Ryan, thank you for the email, and I'm so glad to hear that your son is into this, as he is, because that's one of the challenges, quite frankly, that we have in the collector car world, in the muscle car world, is getting young kids today passionate about automobiles, because there are so many distractions. I mean, stuff that we never had when we were kids, mm-hmm. you know, and those are occupying kids' attention these days, and getting the young
getting
kids
them away from the PlayStation.
You know, yeah. and it's yeah. sad, John, because I read where kids nowadays, you know, don't even really care about when they get their driver's license. They're waiting to get their driver's license. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I mean, 16 years and 1 minute old, I wanted to be at the BMV
getting
my license. And quite frankly, way before that, you know? And it goes back to that passion that we all had when we were younger. And Donald was talking about his favorite era, the chrome and fin era from the 50s, the muscle car era.
Yeah.
That's really what a lot of our specialty is at Mecum. But getting the young kids, and as I call it, muscle car era 2.0. It's going on right now. It's as hot as ever. And it's a great time to introduce kids to the world of motor cars. I sound like I'm British, Donald.
Yeah. Well, you've been hanging around Donald too much, clearly.
Yeah, it's really important that we get the kids into it, not only because of the current cars, but because of the history that goes back to the 60s and the 50s and the 40s and cars that, you know, you drove on the street, not necessarily on the racetrack, but it all goes together. So thank you, Ryan, for helping foster your son's love of the automobile. That's awesome.
Donald, I'm going to take Ryan's question, take it a little further here, and and ask, can you tell me, you know, an odd story about the Indianapolis 500 that hasn't gotten the press? And I'm thinking, you kind of a flavor, and I'll buy you a couple of minutes to think here, or a minute to think.
Oh, dear. Well, I remember when they tons of anecdotes, but
I remember when there was the split between the Indy 500 and the U.S. 500. The newspaper
I
worked
for. Thank you
for bringing it up.
Yeah.
The newspaper I worked for sent me up to Michigan to do a story on the U.S. 500, and I found one of the weird things.
You froze, and you probably thought, what the heck did I come up here for?
Well, I was there, too, and well, I froze, and I wondered the same thing.
Well, there was, but the oddest thing that came out of that is that track was kind of out in the middle of nowhere, was that I uncovered this story about how the auto manufacturers would use that track to test drive their cars, and they would hire housewives from the area to just drive them for 6 or 7 hours straight around the track, often with their kids strapped into the back seat.
And I've never heard that before.
In the late 60s, early 70s. So that's what I'm looking for, something that's kind of oddball, a quirky slice of history that's largely been forgotten about our 500.
Well, I had never heard that before, but I'm not saying that that's not true. It was pretty handy. It was Irish Hills, I think, was the it was either Brooklyn or Irish Hills.
It was Brooklyn.
Or both.
It was Brooklyn, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And so it was fairly handy to go down there. 2 mile track, just sitting there for much of the time, and why not use it? So I didn't know about the housewives and so on and forth, but as far as unusual stories, golly, I mean, I've got a lot. That some of them are probably bordering on shaggy dog stories, but
that's okay. We like shaggy dogs.
Well, here's a short one, and as Scott will tell you, I have a hard time with short stories, but my favorite piece of trivia, and don't groan, I know a lot of people think, oh my God, trivia, but I think this is the greatest piece of general interest trivia to do with the Indianapolis 500, and it is that there have now been, we're about to have a 99th running. It's been going for 104 years. This year, there have been 756 drivers compete in the Indianapolis 500. And the question is, how many drivers have driven with the surname of Smith in the 500? And Scott probably knows the answer.
Yeah, well, he's making the symbol of a big goose egg with his hands.
Yeah.
So,
it's zero, right?
Which is zero. Yeah. There has never been a Smith drive in the Indianapolis 500, which is unbelievable because of it being the most common name in the English language. There's been 9 drivers by the name of Jones, and only 2 of those were related. So it's not like there was a dynasty like with the Andretti's, and I tell people there's a bunch of Andretti's and a bunch of Unsers, but they're all kinfolk.
Yeah.
But there was a bunch of Johnsons and Halls and Hills and Durants, and there's never been a driver by the name of Smith. And I guess I'm going to have a little fun with Scott here. I was going through the entry list for this year to show how things are different. It used to be every driver was American, and maybe some of them first generation, but they were all American with an occasional European showing up. Now it's a little bit different. There's only 12 Americans entered, and you'd have a hard time guessing. Here's some heavy-duty trivia for you. There is one town that has 5 drivers entered for the Indianapolis 500 this year, and I'd say you want to take a crack at it, but I know you're it's highly unlikely that you would get it.
One town.
Bogota, Colombia.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Bogota, Colombia has 5 residents to drive in the Indianapolis 500 this year. So,
wow.
Anyway, those are the kind of things that
well, the odds of a winner from Bogota are pretty high.
Are pretty good, then, yeah. Better than any other cities, anyway. If you are just joining us, we are talking about Indiana's car culture. My guests are Donald Davidson, Katie Haig, and Scott Hoke. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about Indiana's car culture here on No Limits. My guests are Indianapolis Motor Speedway historian Donald Davidson, Katie Haig, who is the deputy director of the Indianapolis Museum of Art, which has an exhibition called Dream Cars right now, and Scott Hoke, who is the host of the Mecum Auctions broadcasts on NBC Sports Network and is a former public address announcer at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Larry has done and reach out to us via Twitter. You can do that at WFYI. Larry asks a question that is a perennial, sort of like, you know, certain flowers and vegetation. Will we ever be able to watch the Indy 500 live on ABC instead of tape delay? It's totally ridiculous. We can't watch live. Who wants that one?
You mean he was talking about here in the Indianapolis
area? Yes,
yes. Obviously.
Yeah.
And I'm going to defer to Donald on that one.
Donald, go.
I don't have an answer. I really don't.
I agree. I don't know that that's ever going to happen. It was a big deal when the first year that the race was offered live outside of Indianapolis, because Donald, for a long time, the race was delayed everywhere in the country, wasn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The first television in Indianapolis was in 1949.
Yeah, Channel 6, right?
Channel 6 went on the air on Memorial Day. That's the first day they were on the air. And they ran a documentary about the 500 was the first thing they did, and then live coverage of the 500 with three cameras.
What a debut.
And then in 1950, they then had regular programs, so they did track reports. And then in 51, they didn't allow TV because they thought it might be hurting the attendance. And so then from 64 to 70, MCA did a closed-circuit TV thing where you'd go to the theater in San Francisco or Albuquerque, New Mexico, or whatever it was, go to the theater and watch it in black and white. And then when that ended, then in 1971, ABC had been chomping at the bit to get the broadcast, but they wouldn't allow them to go live. They did a taped, edited version that night in prime time, and it was blacked out in the Indianapolis area. So people would come to the race and then leave, and then they would drive to Richmond, Indiana, or Terre Haute or Louisville or somewhere that was out of the area, and then they would stay in a hotel and then watch the race being broadcast that night, which if you lived in central Indiana, you couldn't get.
Right.
And then finally, in 1986, they allowed They presented a live broadcast, was going to be broadcast or blacked out locally, I should say. And as luck would have it, it was rained out and ended up being the following week. And what I am told is that the rain out in 1986 was the best viewing audience that they've ever had. Mm. The figures have never been beaten, but As far as it ever being, I think if it was sold out, they might consider it, but I don't see that happening in the foreseeable future.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about Indiana's car culture. Obviously, Indiana in May is pretty much focused on automobiles. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Or on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what regular listener Rev has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Rev, welcome to the program.
Thank you. An unusual question. I thought that the racetrack had a start with balloon racing. Please comment on that. By the way, for your information, tonight at the Irvington Library and next Tuesday at 7 also, they show a series of films on the Indy 500, and they usually have a Mr. Hilton there who's kind of like a Donald a light or a junior Donald Davidson, a wise guy for sure. And I'll give you the password to get in. It's free if you use the password. Listen carefully. Vroom, 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 vroom. Over and out. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Rev. Take care. Okay, Donald, I think that question is probably directed toward you.
The balloon race, it opened with a balloon race. The first competitive event ever held, they planned not only for automobiles, there was to be an aviation presence as well for testing, which there was. And as it happened, the first competitive event was a gas-filled, not hot air, but gas-filled balloon race. In fact, it was the U.S. National Balloon Championships rather than just a balloon race. And Carl Fisher and Jim Allison actually outbid several cities in order to get it here. They just had it the one time. And as far as the Irvington Library meets on Tuesday, June the 9th, your not always humble servant will be there.
Oh, very nice.
To take questions and answers.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Jameson who says, nobody has really talked about the influence of urban community planning on our obsession with cars. Just like Scott said, kids that might have grown up in more suburban areas looked forward to a license at 16 because they could finally get places. The story is much different now as people are choosing more walkable and bikeable neighborhoods. People have been obsessed with cars because they have had to be. Recreational use and interest in cars is a much different thing. Scott, I'll go to you first.
Yeah, interesting point, and a lot of what was said was true. You know, when kids were growing up back in the day, I mean, a lot of kids in rural areas were driving way before they were 16 years old.
Oh, yeah, 12, 13
years
old.
Yeah, farm implements, and you had to learn how to drive, you know. It was a necessity. And, you know, I think that's a good point about, you know, a lot of people, not just here in Indianapolis, but across the country, are moving to a place where they don't necessarily have to use their car. But I think the thing that I like to point out here is that the cars that we're talking about, a lot of times, the cars that Donald fell in love with as a kid and the cars that, you know, are at the IMA exhibit going on until August and the cars that I talk about every day at Meekum are the cars from that time period often where driving was a thing. You got out and you went you just got in the car to go for a drive.
Oh, we talk about cruising.
Yeah, cruise nights.
Yeah.
I mean, how many people do that nowadays? Hey, let's just go for a drive, you know, regardless of whether you live downtown or out of town or in the country or whatever. I think that is almost a lost art, if you will, just to go for a drive.
Katie, how much, you know, in putting this exhibition together with the people who come to see it and all of that, you know, there is, I hesitate to say it because Scott and Don will probably bite my head off here, but there is almost an element in the way they're discussing this of you know, a vanishing culture, at least a somewhat imperiled culture. How much of you know, the Dream Cars exhibition and the people who come is an idea of attempting to preserve a part of culture, and how much of that is nostalgia-driven?
I would say for us, this exhibition is more about celebrating innovation and technology. If you look at the different kinds of vehicles that we have, you can kind of look at the different kinds of engines. And we talk about kind of moving away from driving cars. We look for alternative fuel sources. We have the first electric car that was actually developed in France in the 30s. So for me, it's really about, you know, the aesthetic beauty of the automobile and just being able to appreciate the car really as art, as an artistic object, but then it's really about the innovation. Much of it was really influenced by aircraft technology. They're looking at aerodynamics and streamlining. So for me, it's less about nostalgia and looking backwards as looking to the future and what is possible. What will we be driving in 30 or 50 years? Will we all have flying cars? What is that next step? And so the Dream Cars was really meant to inspire. And if you talk to any of the individual owners of these vehicles, they really want to inspire that next generation of collectors, enthusiasts. As we said, you know, just a few moments ago, there are so many kids today who don't even want to get their driver's license. I have a 15-year-old daughter who's turning 16 in a month, and I'm prepared to buy her a car, and she does not want one. You know, so it's fascinating for me to look at that trend.
I was going to say, I'll take it if she doesn't want it. So.
Well, I'm proud.
You know, it's fascinating.
I'm proud to say that my 15-year-old daughter is dying to get her license, and she asks me all the time, "Daddy, take me driving," and that I'm really happy about that.
Do you work?
Maybe I need to take my daughter to the racetrack and get her a little inspired.
There you go,
Donald. Do you? You know there. It is a different era than it was when Scott and I are roughly the same age. When we were growing up, yeah, getting your license and getting access to the car was a real rite of passage. And frankly, the 500 was a, I'm not going to say it was a better experience because it was just different. I mean, those of us who grew up in central Indiana know that for pretty much the entire month of May then,
yes,
the entire state, not just Indianapolis, was focused on what was going on at the track. And now the events are much more compressed. Obviously, it isn't an entire month-long celebration. Do you worry about some of the changes sort of in that culture?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, to touch on a few, and I'll try and be brief on this, because I've noticed how things have changed is the fact that when I first moved to the area, mid-60s, high school basketball and the track, those were the two big things. High school basketball was huge. I don't have to point that out to many of the listeners. It was unbelievable. And then when the finals were over, then you would think about the track. All the way through the summer and the winter, it seemed that all of automobile racing, all of the sprints and all of the championship races and everything was geared towards what's going to happen in the 500 next year. And then another thing, too, was that I would run into people all over the place, from 10-year-old kids to adults. They'd memorized all the 500 winners. Nobody does that anymore. And then and probably because there's twice as many races that there are now, but it's very, very unusual that I run into somebody that has memorized winners regardless of age. And it used to be that was everybody did that.
Yeah.
The other thing, too, is that the rite of passage for the car, I mean, the kid would get a junker, and he would learn from his older brother or the neighbors or how to work on the car.
Mm-hmm.
And you would either keep it maintained, or if it was broken when you got it, you would fix it up to get it running. Nobody works on a car anymore. Adults don't work on cars because of all of the electronics and everything like that.
Yeah, they're a lot more complicated.
Thousands of dollars worth of equipment. So just the whole car culture thing is different.
It is interesting. We just got an email from a listener named Dick that speaks to your point, Donald, and speaks to why Indianapolis is sort of still a center. And if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. He says, I recently talked to a business acquaintance who moved to Indy and is also a collector of old antique cars. He said this is the place to be because Indy is the home base for many race teams, and it's easy to find shops that can make the replacement parts necessary to restore all cars.
Mm-hmm.
So from that standpoint, Indy may really be the place to be for car fans. Scott?
You know, they're great point. There are a lot of restoration shops. I know there's a speed shop in Bloomington. There are some suspension shops and engine shops in Jasper, Indiana, all over this area, and I think the fact that Indianapolis is known as an automotive center definitely helps that. And we talk about getting kids passionate about the automobile again, and part of that is getting them passionate about bringing some of these basket cases, if you will, back to life, and spending some time learning how to restore and how to rebuild an engine and how to you know, make a body panel smooth and make everything fit together. And I just want to, you know, take just a minute to plug Mecham. You're talking about igniting the passion. I mean, as I mentioned earlier in the show, we have cars that are brand new. We have cars that go all the way back to just after the turn of the century, before there was ever even a race at Indianapolis, and a lot of stuff in between. But I like to call it, these are the cars of our lives. And if you want to come out to the fairgrounds between now and Saturday, it's $20. It's the not just a car auction. Mm-hmm. It's a car show. It's an event. Man, you can look at cars all day long. You can look at manuals and old advertising. Everything associated with the car is going to be out there, and it's a great learning experience and a great teaching tool as well.
I've gotten an email from a listener named Brian, and Brian asks, you know, cruising, fixing up, and customizing can be a bit expensive. Maybe this is one reason younger people are actually unable to take an interest in the car culture. I mean, is there a fear here that at some level they've been priced out, Scott?
Well, there's no doubt that it can be very expensive. And it's we talk about this on our program all the time on NBCSN, that very rarely are you going to take a car, let's say, for example, a 69 Camaro, arguably one of the most popular years ever for that car. If you're going to take a car and restore it, you are very rarely going to get out of it the money that you put into it as a restorer. So it's a labor of love. It really is. It has to be. There has to be that passion there. And he makes a good point. I mean, there are a lot of people, young and old, can be, I don't want to say turned off, but maybe discouraged just because of the price of admission, so to speak, to get into the collector car world these days. But, you know, that being said, there are a lot of cars, and we see a lot of them on our auction block, that are under $10,000, and you can drive away with an awesome vehicle.
Katie, I should not let you go without giving you a chance to tell people, if they want to come see Dream Cars at the IMA, how should they go about it? Got about 30 seconds.
Dream Cars is running through August 23rd, so you have lots of time. June 6th, we have a special family day, and there'll be extra activities, racing remote control cars, and anytime you come to see the exhibition, adults get in for $18 and kids are at $10. We also have a date in our Davis lab. You can design your own automobile on an iPad, and just lots of fun activities kind of throughout the summer. There's a special lecture by our curator, Ken Gross, the car guy, on June 18th. So I encourage people to come out and see him as well.
And that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Katie Haig, Donald Davidson, and Scott Hoke. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
Of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive Producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.